Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that was, since it's gone now, In a Silent Way by Miles Davis. We're playing that because Joe Zonowell, who was one of the founders of the Weather Report, played organ on this recording, and he was born today in 1933. So happy birthday, Joe. Keep on plugging that music away. And reminding you, on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we having a little cultural roundtable here because so many things have happened. We want to get our artists and writers' views on what's happening in our community. From the piece written in the New York Times, which is where we'll start, to climbing up the flagpole to take down the Confederate flag, which I thought was kind of an ultimate act of artistic protest, and a very brave one at that, and how the world of arts fits into all this and where we are now. We're here with Lawrence Birney, who is founder and editor of True Laurels, a great zine, and that I've just discovered with him coming to the program. I'm glad I discovered it. Taylor Evans, independent filmmaker, a student here at Morgan State University. Maura Callahan, performing arts editor for the City Paper. And Cricket Arison, producer, theater maker, and performance artist, currently performing in The World Is Round at Acme Theater. And the last performance is this weekend.
Yeah, it's Thursday through Sunday this weekend.
That's good. I'll be there Saturday. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner or get onto our Facebook pages. But let's start here, because we were talking about this the other morning when we read the piece by Tim Kreider, My Own Private Baltimore, which was at the top of the fold of the New York Times Sunday Review, which is a big section there every week that people read for the week in review. And so since I saw it, I went, oh, Baltimore, top of the fold, let me read this. And I read it, and I won't say what I thought until I hear what other people think, and we'll talk about what this piece said, but it was about the person who did it. Is a cartoonist who used to work for the City Paper, put things in the City Paper, very creative guy, and it's about a certain look at how Baltimore is in a drunken stupor at dive bars. And Maura, you had something. Let me start with you, since it is your paper, City Paper, and you also put a blog up about it.
Yeah, I thought it was a really weird piece. I felt like it kind of got at just the outer surface of out of Baltimore, in that it really just looked at the eccentricities of Baltimore. And I think that's something that Baltimore is known for. But I think now more than ever, it should be clear to outsiders that there's a lot more to Baltimore than just, you know, weird people and prostitutes and dive bars.
And the romanticization of this, I think, but got to me a little bit as well, Lawrence, when I was looking at this. Right?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the article is that a lot of stuff that I read about Baltimore, especially recently, it doesn't really speak to my experience as a black person growing up in Baltimore. And this is just another one on the list. All he really talked about was, you know, like Maura just said, just drunk people, prostitutes, going into the bar, having, like, you know, good old time. But I feel like if that came from somebody like me, it'd be looked at a little differently. It would be.
Like a
reckless person.
Right. Right. Well, I want to get into this, what you just said. Cricket?
Yeah, well, I've been thinking a lot about how one of the main hallmarks of privilege is being able to tell your story as though it's the default and as though it's everyone's experience. And to me, this is such a good example of that because, you know, he can tell his story of his early 20s, which were spent drunkenly carousing. That's fine. But the part of the article that really bothered me was that he used that to say, and this is what Baltimore is. No one here has ambition. Everyone here is like me. Everyone here, has the exact same priorities. And to me, that just really got my goat. Because that's not my experience of the city, and it's not my experience that people here aren't ambitious. And I just think there's another aspect, too, which is using people as props. Everyone who shows up in his article is just a prop to him, you know, and it's fetishizing poverty. he's saying, I was at a bar with a person with an actual lobotomy scar. And I was talking to a mm-hmm. friend of mine about this yesterday, and she was like, yeah, you know why people have lobotomy scars? Because they can't afford adequate health care, you know, and then they wind up with lobotomies. And so he's just saying, ha, 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 I was in this bar with this person who can't afford adequate health care. And then I moved to New York, and now I'm happy and successful. So it just really annoyed me.
Yeah, definitely.
Just look close to my table.
I definitely agree with you about how the article definitely doesn't show everybody's side of their life and experience in Baltimore because, well, I do like how he said that, you know, he's only been arrested once. That's definitely something that I think if you are a black man getting drunk on the street, you probably that number will go up. And, you know, I didn't like how he was talking about the lady with dreads, you know, a big, nasty dread. Like, what is that? That is so disrespectful. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I remember, and pointless.
And, yeah. and pointless. I've actually seen the woman he's talking about. She's a woman that... that bothered me as well. A little detail was because I've seen that woman. She's an older woman, probably my age, maybe older. She's an older woman, and she's white, and clearly homeless, and clearly has kind of mentally disabled, and has this one. Her hair is a giant mat, you know, and also kind of disrespecting what dreads are, what they are, and that, I know who he was talking about. I don't know the woman, but I've seen her in. Nodded to her and said something on the street as we passed. But I know exactly what he was talking about. But I think the whole thing there that bothered me was that looking at this was like this sense of what you said a moment ago, Cricket, about privilege. That kind of very white hipster, I can be drunk and be out there crowd. Going to dives that they would not even know about, places I might have hustled as a kid that they wouldn't even know existed, you know. And I think that kind of stuff is just it was kind of condescending about the city and the mm-hmm. people and who they are. And you were right, Lawrence. I mean, if that had been somebody who somebody said this one before. Maybe it was you, Taylor. I forget who said it. But if it had been somebody who was black in this community, remembering. How you got drunk with prostitutes and drugs, it would be seen in a whole different life, right?
You'd be a thug.
You wouldn't be hip.
Yeah,
you'd be a thug.
I think it was also funny how he even summarized the black part of Baltimore in his piece. I wrote it down. He said that other Baltimore, hungry and disenfranchised, heavily armed, written off by politicians, pushed around by the cops and caught animals on the internet, was always blocks away. That just felt like... Some editor was like, don't forget to mention the blacks. Just put a little piece in there just to let them know that, you know, at least mm-hmm. you can acknowledge them. But it's like he doesn't go into any detail. It's just like, you know, I just want to let people know that I know about it, even though I never had to deal with it. It was a few blocks away, but, you know, I know about it.
Yeah. And also in regards to when he said that people in Baltimore don't, I guess we lack up. We why are we still here if we are trying to be something? You know, it's a lot of opportunity in Baltimore. It's a lot of good people in Baltimore, and it's a lot of people who want to work together in Baltimore. And he kind of made that seem like people want to work for free or nobody's getting any money. But it's like, you know, it's okay to work with people for free. It's okay to build something together. It doesn't mean that you're lacking opportunity, or like it doesn't mean that you're declining as a person that you should move just because you're in Baltimore.
Yeah, and also it his definition of ambition seems to be really narrow. Mm-hmm. Like it's for him, it seems that ambition is hoping to get paid for your work and to receive money for your work. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just a very narrow definition. And I think ambition, in the way that he's seeing it, is also a very it's both racial and gendered, because ambition for a white guy is not. I mean, people of color and women, we are not given the same level of encouragement to be ambitious. And when we do, that encouragement is kind of blind to the obstacles that we face in you know, meeting our goals.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Maybe you haven't read the article, but to get a sense of what we're talking about. When I read it Sunday again, I just read it and went, oh, my God, do I even want to talk about this in the air? I wasn't sure, but I thought it would deserve at least a little pushback. Which is why we started here, 410-319-8888. But there's a lot of things going on. I'm thinking about All of you represent in many ways very different mediums in terms of your artistic worlds. And you all people here who have a social conscience about where you think this we should be and the way you write and act and work with groups and films you do and the writing. And so I think about what it means to have kind of an artistic response to what we're facing. And, you know, when you saw Bree Newsom climb up that flagpole and take down that Confederate flag, and now she's become like the superhero that people are cartooning around the country. But when I saw that, I was just blown away by the act. I mean, I don't know if I was alone in that, but it was just so overwhelmingly powerful to see her do that as a young woman up on that flagpole, in danger to herself, taking down that Confederate flag. The symbolism of her holding it out like this and saying, yes, I'm coming down. I don't care if you arrest me. I'm ready.
Yeah, I like everything she stood for. I feel like she showed people that, you know, you can't have fear. You have to go out and do what you want to do in order to stand up for what you believe in. And so I think that was her biggest message with that, you know, not to be ashamed or to fear anybody when it comes to your personal thoughts and what you believe in. You have to take those steps and you have to do what you want to do or what you have to do in her case, you know.
Yeah, Greg.
Yeah, I think she's so brave and I really enjoyed that as, you know, I really celebrated that moment. And I think it was really amazing because it showed the power that a symbolic act can have. To be honest, when I first, you know, after the massacre in South Carolina, I was really surprised how quickly that turned around and a lot of the dialogue about it became about the Confederate flag. I wasn't expecting that immediate response of a bunch of people saying we need to take this down. And I paused for a moment and I was like, it's interesting that this symbol has become, the symbolic thing has become what everyone is demanding to come out of this horrific act. And then the more I thought about it, I realized symbols obviously have power, and that's a lot of what art is about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's rare now, the dialogue around race in this country gets really complicated really quickly, and there's so much history and there's so much emotion that goes into it. And so it's rare now that there are moments like that that are just so viscerally powerful and so symbolic to everyone who sees it, that that communicate a lot of that complexity in a 5-minute, you know, performance or action. And I think that's partially why it really grabbed everyone's attention.
Yeah, like everybody, I think it was very powerful. And I'm glad that a woman could stand up and do that, showed a lot of bravery. Because usually we celebrate men for being heroes, for standing up, making changes. And I think she had a certain level of bravery that a man wouldn't have. You know, a black man may have to second guess that just subconsciously. Like, if I climb up here, I might not get back down. Mm-hmm. And she just took it on her back to do it. Honestly, when I first, my feelings were mixed when I first saw it.
What was that?
I didn't look at it just for her bravery, even though I always recognized it. But a lot of it has been going around about the Confederate flag. I look at the American flag the same way. You know, we can all get caught up in recognizing the South as being, you know, part of this cruel act, which was slavery, but it existed in the North too. You know, a piece just came out in the Gothamist yesterday about New York having...
In the what?
Gothamist.
Oh, Gothamist, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And they talked about how many tributes they still have to slave owners and people who were prosecutors that had slaves burned at the stake, Delancey Street, Chamber Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at it as a, it's definitely an accomplishment, but it's just halfway there.
Well, then I'm going to push and explore a bit. Mara, you want to jump in on this at all?
I was just going to say that it was very ambitious. I mean, that I think that the fact that she got so much attention for that, is continuing to get attention for it. I think that's been the case with a lot of performance art lately, taking place in very socially problematic areas. You know, taking that focus away from New York, to go back to Kreider's piece, you know, I think the focus is shifting, and I think it was just really, really courageous.
So it leads me to the point where we think that the work that people do as cultural people, as cultural warriors, whatever you want to call yourselves, people call each other, but in response to it, what happens around us. I mean, like the act we just saw there. The Confederate flag is a symbol. And as you said, cricket art is a symbolic act in its own. I mean, when we do things artistically, it's making a statement. You can make a statement like Grider did. You can make a statement like people did in the streets. You can make a statement like the cast of Marley did at North and Penn during the middle of the uprising. They came and performed and shared songs and dancing in the street with the people who were out there, right? Mm-hmm. Or it could be like the piece, the a cappella group. I think we sent around this article about them. I'm blanking the name. Will come to me in a minute. But the a cappella group who in San Francisco, high school kids at the equivalent of the Oakland Baltimore School for the Arts, an incredible group, a mixed racial group from the high school kids from there. And then when they finished the concert, they all turned around and written across their backs was Black Lives Matter and a statement to the audience, those kind of things. I mean, so how important are those acts? I mean, what do you think they mean? How do you think they challenge what we do? How do you think people see that kind of response from young people, from artists in general?
I think people find encouragement in it, and I think it is a duty for creative people to add some type of commentary on the lot in the world that we live in. When everything happened here, I wrote a piece for Vice about my personal experiences with police and my family's experience with police. My sister was put out of all Baltimore City schools because of the confrontation she had with a police who jumped her, tried to break her hands, lied and said did things that she couldn't do, and they gave her charges. My stepbrother was beaten outside of Melba's nightclub last year. Just for having an argument with the bouncer, and police saw, and they just jumped on him, beat him bloody. He had an asthma attack while they were beating him. So I think the more voices, the better. People need to know, whether you're a writer, a musician, a performance artist, filmmaker, just let people know.
Something that I've come to realize, and I think a lot of young creative people are realizing, is that all art, at least all good art, all effective art, is in a way activism, because good art will create new ways of seeing the world and the new ways of seeing society that may be really exaggerated or abstracted, but they reveal a lot of truth that the way we see the world without art does not.
During the unrest, I filmed, two different views, I guess, of what was going on. So the day after the looting, I filmed the protests, and they were really, really positive. And there was a group of guys out there playing their jazz instruments, and they were singing the song. It went, "I'm so glad I'm from Baltimore." And at that moment, even though I'm always happy that I'm from Baltimore, I was really proud to be from Baltimore and to see everybody, all different types of people there singing, "I'm so glad I'm from Baltimore." It was a sense of healing that, all this is going on, but at the same time, I'm still happy that I'm from Baltimore. And, music is kind of like a drug. It can make you feel up or down depending on how it is. And that's the type of art. And so, I feel like we need, and even through my films, I have a film called The Cage Bird where I took the stuff that I got, I wrote the film based off of other people's relationships and my own relationships and people that I know from Baltimore City, the relationships that they go through. And I feel like films can encourage people. I had so many girls coming up to me or telling me after I released the film, like, "Oh my gosh, I was a caged bird. I was crying." And I really didn't expect that. But I was like, I really could use my films to encourage people to, do better or just to think a certain way. So, art and all definitely encourages people, or, art can be a serious sense of healing, and it's needed because you can't always just tell somebody that something is right and wrong. You need art to do that sometimes.
Sometimes I know I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. Sometimes I think I'm a weird person to talk about art and politics because I have kind of an ambivalent relationship or an ambivalent view of the relationship between art and politics. And I mean, I agree with what both of you are saying, that it can be super important. But I also think that good political art has to come out of good art. And I think that a lot of times, like the grants that go to support community art or like social change-based art often put art second and put social change first. And to me, sort of like what Maura was saying, where it's like art, even if it doesn't have an explicitly political message, can be explicitly political because it's about reimagining the way that we live in this world, and it's about reimagining how we relate to each other as people, and that can be a radical act. That being said, I don't think that that radical act can be substituted for organizing and, you know, community engagement. So I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about this, and I don't have an answer to it. I do think that when, you know, with the examples that you've been talking about, art has proven really powerful as a political change agent. And there are so many examples of that throughout history. But I also think that sometimes when people talk about political art in an institutional setting, what they really mean is art that's going to aid economic development in a way that is going to, you know, benefit not the people in the communities that where the art is happening. So I know that was a tangled web of thoughts about it is very tangled, and I don't know the answer.
So I
totally agree.
Oh, is it Mara? Go ahead, Mara.
Yeah, sorry. I totally agree. I mean, I think that a lot of the political art that people pay attention to, it's often, you know, exhibited in institutions like MoMA, which has a long history of, you know, not being very inclusive in what they show, and then that work becomes sort of tokenized work. But I think there is a lot of art that out there, like the act of taking down the Confederate flag, that challenges that the way that happens.
So, I mean, let's take an example of what's going on right here in Baltimore and how we respond to that. You know, when we see all the Confederate monuments are in the city. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Hear your thoughts on this. You see all the Confederate monuments in this town. And you every day, because our offices are at 32nd and St. Paul. So if I'm coming from a certain direction, I have to go down Museum Drive to see if I go from that direction, right? So I'm always passing the Stonewall Jackson Robert E. Lee Monument on my right. And I've noticed there for years it was there. You know, years and years and years and years and years and years back, way back, we did a little something there where we just put kind of posters of lynchings and other things around that monument. This was back in the early 70s as kind of a protest, that thing even being there. But then we forgot about it and people forgot about it, but the statue's still there. But what to do with things like that? I mean, that whether you like what they represent, that's art, right? Those pieces of sculpture are art done by a really good sculptor who made a wonderful piece of work. But it was a piece of work that lauds these racist secessionists who were, if there's another country who were, if you realizing that the North was as racist as the South, but if you look at the larger history of America, these folks who were lionizing were traitors to the larger sense of the country. So there's a statue to them. So what is the artistic response to that? I threw out there, and I said we should move those statues, unearth them, pick them up, mm-hmm. move them to a place, and create a park, an artistic world that responds to those statues, where we wrestle with questions of race and poverty and our history and who we are, so that they're there for us to kind of and have things in response to them artistically. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because they are there. And I don't want to be like ISIS kind of blowing up statues. I just can't go there. But I think that there's something you can do to how we respond to that, because I think that because what we are seeing in our world now is this kind of push around race and racism in America like I've never seen before in my entire life. I mean, there's a push to end segregation, and many of us were part of that, went to jail, but that's different than what we're experiencing now, which is this larger push against racism and understanding how race played a role in society, the deep role it plays in America and the sinew and tissue of who we are as people. So how do we respond to that? How, you know, as people, not as a top-down, beat them across the head political art, but as artists rising up from the bottom responding to that, you know? What does this note say to me? Yeah. So that's. Let's take a quick break and come right back so we can take your time when you get there. And we'll go to break and we'll come right back and we'll wrestle with that. I'm lonely as I can be. I'm waiting for your company. I'm hoping that you come back to me. That's Pine Top Perkins, born on this day in 1913. And we went to break. You heard I'm Walking by the Great Fats Domino, because in 1956 on this day, a riot broke out at his concert in San Jose. They just weren't ready for Fats. But we're ready for this conversation. Join us here at 410-319-8888 with Lawrence Burney, founder and editor of True Laurels, Taylor Evans, filmmaker and student here at Morgan State University, Maura Callahan, performing arts editor of City Paper, Cricket Arison, producer, theater maker, performance artist, currently in The World Is Round at the Acme Corporation at St. Mark's Church from Thursday to Sunday?
Yes, Thursday to Sunday, corner of North and St. Paul.
There you go. So, yes, join us. We'll be there. Have fun Saturday night. Check this out. 410-319-8888. Call back. We get right to your phone calls at 410-319-8888. So what should be our response? How do you take that as artists, looking at this work of art, celebrating this stuff, and what do we do with it? Where do we go?
I think history should be preserved. I just don't think it should be just among us as we walk every day, subconsciously. Just, you know, we're influenced by that, whether we like
yeah.
it or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it should be put in a museum or something, just the same way, you know, the N-word was taken out of Huck Finn. I don't agree with that. I don't think history should be ran away from. It shouldn't be erased. But it has a place, and I don't think that place is just out among the people.
Yeah, the idea that I've been thinking about is you could hire artists to create other works of art around the monuments and sculptures where they are now, you know, that would be a direct response to that. So it wouldn't just be without context or without a current response or, you know, take them out. I don't think leaving them where they are without anything else there is the right response. But I also think that you have to be careful with things like that. I was just saying during break, you have to be careful because the response shouldn't make you feel better about it. I think you shouldn't, like, taking down the Confederate flag is a powerful symbol and is important, but that shouldn't make us feel like, well, we did our job today, you know, racism mm-hmm. is done. And I think that symbolic acts are powerful, and so because of that, you have to be careful not to rely only on them. So whatever the response is, I think it needs to be a deeper engagement than just taking them out, putting them away, and then congratulating ourselves that we're so much better than we were 50 years ago.
Yeah, I definitely agree as far as I don't think that they should stay there, you know, just amongst us. Kind of, they're not being celebrated, but I guess overlooked, because honestly, I didn't know about this.
The statue?
Yeah, the statue that you were talking about.
It's right across from
I've probably seen it. I know I've seen it.
Baltimore Museum of Art.
Okay.
Right on Museum Drive.
Yeah.
As you come off Howard Street and go around there, it's right there on the right as you're driving around there.
Well, yeah, so I agree with Lawrence about, you know, not keeping them there, but not altering history either, because, you know, in schools, they don't really teach us our true history. Well, they don't teach us our true history. So I feel like all of these historical things that are in Baltimore City and just around us need to be taught, but not celebrated.
Because there has to be some response artistically to these things. When you said what being taught, one of the things I read an article this morning about Texas. And Texas is putting out new history books for their public school curriculums that will not talk about segregation, that will talk about the Civil War in terms of states' rights and not focus on slavery. I mean, and there, it's a conscious – this is what I mean. There's an intellectual, artistic war going on right now in America with itself. And part of it is not that all art has to be political, but by its nature – all art has some politics in it just by the nature of work. But that we are, I think we're in this war. We're in a war for the heart and soul and minds of the future of America, for your generation and the generation after you, about what's going to come. You know, and I think that, and the artists have a role to play in that, in what's in battling for the heart and mind of people.
I don't think the America's war with itself is not now. It's been like that.
Well, we're at a different stage with it
now,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, because I've been reading a lot more over the past few years I read this book called Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And learned about John Brown, like, you know, a white abolitionist who took into his own hands to retaliate against slavery. He was celebrated at one point in history around the time of his death in history books.
By a few people anyway.
Right? By a few people. But but now in books, he's just a crazy person if they mention him at all.
Right. Right. No, right. And I think that's what I'm talking about, that is kind of the role that I think about what we do. Because I think in some ways what we do on radio even is an artistic role, by bringing stuff to the airwaves and doing programs and bringing history to life, is that because you have to challenge that. So the question is, what do we use art? I mean, and I know there's a resistance, I'm correct from what you were saying about using the art to always be that challenge, but art is a challenge to that. You know, I mean, it's how you put on a play, a painting about John Brown and all the people who worked with to tell a different story. You know, if he hadn't stayed in that damn Harper's Ferry Armory for the extra time he spent and actually got to the mountains, he might have changed the whole course of American history. That's reality, right? Or not he, but all the men and women around him. So, I mean, I'm just curious how we tackle that. Do you think we're at a place where we're wrestling with something very deep in this country? And people like you, as artists, have a huge role to play in that.
Yeah, like I said earlier, I feel like art is a sense of healing. It's a way that people can look at things in a different way than, you know, what... Well, art is like a way to look at reality different. So, you know, hearing that in Texas they're trying to, you know, change that history books, I feel like artists like myself, like I want to start making films that could teach people about our true history, but in a creative way, in a way that'll keep people attentive but still make them think, especially the younger generation who doesn't know a lot about our history because our schools have further stopped them from learning it, you know.
Or, you know, if next to that statue that Harriet Tubman was the only woman, black or white, to lead troops in the Civil War that liberated over 700 slaves and broke the back of the Confederate Army in South Carolina. But who knows that? Is that anywhere? Right? That's nowhere.
I think social media is playing a really big role right now, too. I don't
How
know
so?
If you could call that art.
Yeah.
But it may be looked at as art hundreds of years from now when it's in a museum. It's getting our art out there. We don't need institutions anymore. As a writer, I have written for City Paper, Vice Magazine, and other magazines, but I don't need it necessarily. I could reach the consumer directly. I can have a community on social media that circulates that story and it gets to people. It's a lot of things being done because of Twitter right now. People being fired for being discriminatory, or just getting someone's name out there, somebody otherwise that could duck into the shadows and resurface and be okay for the rest of their lives. So I think social media is a really good piece of our culture.
Mara, you want to leap in? I'm sorry, we haven't heard from you.
Absolutely. I think social media is playing an incredibly huge role, and I think we're seeing the effects of that already, but there are definitely probably bigger, I think, positive effects that we'll see after a long time. And I was just thinking about how in high school I was taught American history by a Confederate war reenactor.
Where was that?
Carver High School.
Oh, in Baltimore County?
In Towson.
Uh-huh.
as you can imagine, it was messy at times. But at least I was being taught that part of history. You know, the teacher didn't try to hide what happened. And, you know, some of the ways that he taught it I disagreed with. But at least I was learning about the Confederacy and about slavery. And I was able to make my own judgments about whether or not that was right. So going back to the statues, I think I agree that they should not be destroyed. And the idea of them staying there and being paired with artistic responses is very interesting. And you know, a lot of people are saying that about the Confederate flag. You know, getting rid of it isn't going to erase the sins of this country, but keeping it there is very, very insulting and, I think, a violent act against people who were affected by that. By the Confederacy.
So I'm curious what people think. What should we do with those statues? What should our response be at 410-319-8888? We have a chat over here. Destroying those statues is not the same as ISIS. ISIS is destroying ancient cultural artifacts. This is a 6-year-old statue, it's not the same. So, well, it's not the same maybe in some ways. In 1948 was when the Dixiecrats broke away from the Democratic Party to form the Segregationist Party to run for president. That's the same year these statues were put up there. And I bet you a dollar to a donut that the folks put those statues up probably voted for Strom Thurmond for president of the United States. 410-319-8888, your thoughts about that and more. We want to hear your thoughts on what our cultural response should be to all of this at 410-319-8888. You know, and so when you look at groups like Black Lives Matter, and when they were in Baltimore here and they walked into various establishments for people serving Sunday breakfast, and they had different responses in different places, which I found was interesting. Some people got been applauded, some people didn't know what to say and they got embarrassed. But how does that work as art?
I think it's the most effective way is direct, which I feel like all art should be to some extent. And it makes people uncomfortable, which is just a fraction of the discomfort you feel as a black person growing up here. I mean, good. If people can be this uncomfortable for an hour, it still doesn't equal it. So the more people that is brought to, the more important that it is.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Yeah, and as a theater artist and a live performance artist, I really appreciate things like that because I think that one of the things that live performance brings is, a person-to-person connection that is radical and is often really easy to ignore these days. So the fact that they actually went in and confronted people and were there with their bodies in the same room as these other people who are, eating brunch, that moment in time, I think, is a really important aspect of art that, social media can't provide, that, even watching a video can't provide. And even if, hopefully those people took that discomfort, and I'm sure it was very uncomfortable for them, and actually thought about it instead of just, rejecting it and pushing it away. But I think that statements like that can be really powerful. And I keep thinking, I don't know, did anyone else here see Kara Walker's A Subtlety exhibit in New York? It was that giant sugar sphinx.
Oh, yes, that had so controversial. Did anybody see that?
I saw it in person.
You saw it in person?
Yeah, I saw it in person. And I just keep thinking about that because that, to me, is a really brilliant example of what political art can look like because, it was this giant white sugar sphinx that filled this warehouse, and then a bunch of sculptures made out of molasses and tar that were supposed to look like sugar babies. And what wound up happening, what I think was really brilliant, the art itself was really beautiful, and then there was this big reaction about it because people were taking pictures, like really silly selfies, in front of the genitals on this sculpture. And it's a sculpture about, like black women's pain and about the pain of slavery, and people were taking all these ridiculous selfies in front of it. And then it turned out, and that was a big controversy, and then it turned out that she was actually also taping the audience the whole time. So what originally seemed like, oh, all of these people are, they're messing with her art, was actually the joke was on them, and she was taping them and turned it all around. And so it was all these layers of art that was really beautiful but also really emotionally affecting to be there, and also tied in with the way that we talk about these things in social media, and was both, a spectacle but also a physical place you could be. And so that to me is an example of what really good political art can be. That's not hitting you over the head with the message. It makes you think about it a lot.
Yeah, I think art is making a statement, a statement that brings people out of their comfort zone, and it makes them think. So with, like you said, the Black Lives Matter group going into this establishment, I think that definitely is art. Because it is definitely effective because just facing somebody front forward is, to me, the best type of art, especially if it makes people, like I said, especially if it brings them out of their comfort zones.
And that piece in New York, I don't know, did you see that piece in New York, Mara? Were you up there to see that?
I didn't. I didn't get a chance to see it in person, but it was really incredible.
I've read that and when that came out, there was a lot of pushback also from the black artist community who saw it as a self-hating piece. And that went back and forth, too. But that's what art is supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah, it's supposed to make you argue.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And not to make you comfortable with what you're seeing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones.
Makes you think.
Makes you think, you hope. 410-319-8888. William, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mrs.
Hi, William. Welcome.
And your guest.
Hello.
This is a quick response to the statues and the flag of the Confederacy.
Okay.
What would be the take for Negro or African-American, whatever the label is today, what would be the take on the Stars and Stripes? Because the flag of the Confederacy came well after 13 colonies were established. And that flag, the Stars and Stripes, when they added the stars as the states grew, that flag was the symbol of America. And at that time, Africans were still being purchased. So the motivation to take down the Confederate flag and those corresponding statues puzzles me, when clearly the Stars and Stripes represents a vast amount of thorough disrespect to all kinds of people, white and black. So what's the response to, the mm-hmm. Stars and Stripes so much as the Confederate flag?
That's a really good question. And you raised that question earlier in the conversation.
Yeah, I agree with it. I mentioned that earlier today, and that was really my first reaction when a lot of this stuff started happening. As a black person, you can't look at the American flag and have any sense of pride, in my opinion. I would never pledge allegiance to the flag again. I would never stand up for that. Like I said, the Confederacy wasn't alone in slavery. The Union had slaves. They may have abolished it earlier, but the money that slavery got them is still being built upon. So, yeah, they're all the same to me.
Yeah, I agree. How I stopped saying the Pledge of Allegiance when I can't remember, but I was in high school. Middle school. I know they used to make us stand up, and it was a time when I was like, oh, I don't have to stand up to say this because, I mean, it's not for me. It's not, for my people to be proud of the American flag or the Confederate flag, yes.
Folks, what do you think? 410-319-8888. I throw out a story and our other two guests can jump in. This made me think of this as y'all were talking. A friend of mine who's an artist and many other things, he's Kiowa. He lives on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. And we've been friends for a long time. And he came to visit in Baltimore, and we were hanging out, and it was winter. And we left my daughter's house. We were having dinner. And as we're driving down and hit Northern Parkway, there was an American flag in the snow. Mm-hmm. It was just laying there, crumpled up, right? So he said, turn around. I said, what do you mean turn around? I want to get this flag. What? He said, turn around. I want to get the flag. So I did. I turned around and we made this U-turn in the middle of the street and came back and stopped and he came and grabbed the flag and put it in the car, and we drove off. And I said, well, why'd you do that, man? I said, how many thousands of your people died genocidally under this flag? But then he also said, that's true, but there are all kinds of contradictions in life, and a lot of my friends and family died fighting for that flag. And so, I'm saying the contradictions were abound, right? Whether in that world, I mean, there were Buffalo soldiers who died in that flag. Black troops always died under that flag as well. That's what I'm saying. The contradictions were abound in how you respond to the symbols that we see.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Jim. I jump in.
There are a lot of contradictions. It's very complex. But I can't get past it. I can't get past
what I know it represents.
Right. Whether, a lot of people that fight for this country, hats off to them. That's their choice. But the American flag represents what it represents to me.
It was one point I was having a conversation with my cousin. I have a lot of Army vets in my family, my father, my uncle, my brother, my grandfather, my cousins. So I was at one point really in disagreement with soldiers going to fight, but now I'm not. But he told me, you know, we're fighting so that we can feel safe in our country, our families can feel safe. And so, but I was still thinking, you know, there were times when they would send soldiers to fight and it would be segregated and they would be in, at different race ranks, you know? So it's like they still weren't respected, even if they were fighting for our country at, you know, a long time ago, probably still today. But I know at one point they were definitely segregated, even though we are all supposedly fighting for America.
Right, right.
So it's like Lauren said, how can I really respect the flag or really the history of this country?
Let's go back to the phones. Come back to our other two guests as well. 410-319, unless you want to jump in right here and there. 410-319-8888. Wayne, you're on the air. Line one.
Yeah, good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Mark, I'm an old neighbor of yours in Windsor Hills, and I'll leave it like that.
Okay, yeah, Wayne, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm very well, man. Good to hear you.
Yeah. Hey, just wanted to mention, was listening to the show, don't get a chance to call in, but I just wanted to mention, I agree with everything the guests are saying, but I just had a little revelation about that American flag. I felt one time, too, that I wouldn't say pledge allegiance to it, but, you know, my father was in the military, and there was a lot of black veterans that fought to uphold that flag. And I think, and that was one of the things that brought me back. You know, I mean, to say that it's, you know, not for our people, I kind of agree on scale, and with all due respect to your guests. But let's just keep in mind, you know, our black folks and fathers died for that flag. And I use it sometimes as a source of pride. I don't necessarily parade it around, but, you know, I kind of, I cherish it just a bit from that point, because my father defended that flag, and there were a lot of black folks that defended that flag. Yes. So let's just keep that in mind when we say we don't want to, you know, do this or do that with the flag. It's a part of our history, and I really think that we should embrace it in some kind of a way and not totally walk away from it. The flag is over my father's grave right now, and I proudly do that. So I just wanted to add that.
All right.
And thank you, and I'll take the answer off here.
Wayne, thanks so much.
I don't know if we fought for the flag or for the principle that we thought we were fighting for, I guess, of freedom or of safety, rather, in our country. But is it really for the flag? You know.
And that's, again, I think, Mara, some of the symbolism here, because it's all about symbols.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just thinking, there is the response to issues like this. I mean, obviously, this would be a lot harder to do with the American flag, because that's such a powerful symbol. But in situations like this where there's images or language even that's problematic or represents something that is harmful, there is the act of reclaiming it. Like the way that, for example, the LGBTQ community reclaimed the word queer. That's one response to dealing with those harmful symbols and words. But I don't know how you would do that with the flag.
I remember Kanye West wanted to reclaim the Confederate flag by wearing it.
Oh, yeah.
For fashion.
I remember that.
And I love Kanye West. He is my favorite. I know. That's a different conversation.
That's good.
I love his music. I love his music back in the day. Anyway, so. But, yeah, so, you know, that was one thing that I just could not agree with. And then I had an ex-boyfriend who wanted to do the same thing. And I'm like, what? How is that ever, ours? How was the Confederate flag ever for black people to rejoice about? Like,
it makes me think of the video I was watching that my producers pulled up yesterday, Kendrick Lamar's latest piece that was at the BET, where both the American flag and that symbol, the symbolism was very prominent in his piece, as was Baltimore. Right? Mm-hmm. He got a lot of criticism from some corners around that piece, but I thought it was pretty powerful.
Yeah, I think Kendrick is doing some of the most interesting stuff in rap right now as far as the symbolism, what he's talking about. At least he is talking about it, you know. I can have my critiques of him as an artist, but I do appreciate that he's at the forefront, being conscious of his position within the game, and wanting to get that out to people, I think is very important. But in response to the caller, I don't think anybody is disrespecting who quote unquote died for the flag. I think we all have some kind of some family who's been in the military. It's just stepping away from your own personal connection to it and really analyzing things for what they are.
Phones 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jake. Line two, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Stein, how are you?
Very well, Jake. Welcome.
Good, wonderful show as always. I agree with your callers to a great extent about the flag, but also like the caller that was before me kind of stole my thunder. I also had some mixed feelings about it, but I had to come back to kind of recognize it as a symbol, given that a lot of African Americans have given their life for not necessarily the flag, as your guest has said, but for the principles that it's supposed to represent. Mm-hmm. When you look at the contributions of African people in military service and in the building of this country through slavery on up, I think we become like the quintessential Americans. And so I think in terms of symbolism, that flag has to have some kind of value and has to resonate and have some, you know, we have mixed feelings. But I do understand what they're saying, but I think it should have a place of respect. And as African Americans, I think when we look at what America is, we kind of built this. We're kind of quintessential Americans. And from every fight, we've been there. I mean, you know, first revolutionaries. I mean, you know, we've been there with all the battles. And if this is America, and we are here, and we symbolize America, I think it should have some value.
Jack, I appreciate the call, and actually you've taken us to the end of the hour here, and I appreciate this discussion, which has been really wide-ranging. You all four are really fascinating thinkers and characters in your own right. I want to thank you all for being a Cricket Harrison catcher this weekend until Thursday through Sunday in the play she's doing, The World is Round, at Acme Corporation, which will be at St. Mark's Church.
Yep. St. Paul and Saint, North.
St. Paul and
Saint
North.
St. Mark's Church, yeah.
Mark Callahan, performing arts editor of the City Paper. Taylor Evans, filmmaker and student here at Morgan State University. Lawrence Burney, a founder editor of True Laurels. If you've not checked it out, you need to check it out. I was really blown away when I first saw it. I hadn't seen it until I knew you were coming on the show, but I love the work you're doing, man.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Thank you all for being here with this discussion. It meant
a lot.
Thank you.
And thank you all for tuning in and making the show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Engineering intern is Anthony Nichols. Our intern and day in history research producer is Sienna Greaves. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And on our way out of here, it's Birdland by Weather Report. Joe Zenwall of Weather Report was born this day in 1933. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.